Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we are talking with Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Communication and Operations for the Maine Department of Labor.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. And Pam McGathlin, the Director of Bureau of Labor Standards.
Good morning.
For all those listeners out there, you'll know that I went through this 4 or 5 times to get that right. But anyways, it's okay. We're talking with two people from the Department of Labor, and they're not auditing me, so I'm happy. So we're all right.
There you go.
It's all good today. All right. So, you know, Pam, there have been a lot of things that are going on in terms of labor standards. And there's a big change that just happened at the federal level, or at least is getting ready to happen for 2016, having to do with exempt and non-exempt discussion of not only minimum wage, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, but also about the exempt rules that are going to be changing for the levels and amount of money that somebody has to make to be on salary. So let's start there. Let's start with that discussion point. What are some of the new proposed regulations, and how are they going to affect us?
Well, the U.S. Department of Labor is going to, or has issued new rules. The Obama administration's proposing rules changes that affect both the overtime regulations, and although it's federal law, the Maine statute does require that state law reflect the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. So in the proposed rules changes, this looks like if it goes through, we will be seeing significant changes in the way overtime is structured for all employers nationwide, and including those employers who fall directly under Maine law. So, Pam, do you want to break it down?
Currently, well, let's clarify one thing. When we say the word salary, it's a misconception that salary means no overtime. One of the things we need to define is if it's salary exempt or salary non-exempt. Any individual could be paid on a salary. The question is, the duties they perform will exempt them or not exempt them from the overtime regulations under the Fair Labor Standards Act, which we refer to the FLSA. Under these new regulations, currently the current threshold is $455 a week is the guaranteed salary amount in order to hold these major three exemptions on individuals. What this proposed rule is looking to do is raise that threshold into a higher level, which would be $970 a week, which is more than double the current threshold, which will impact many businesses in Maine, especially the small businesses in Maine, who have a lot of the managers / assistant managers that are not at that level of threshold. They might be making somewhere between that $500-$700 threshold, but not at that $970.
Well, you know, the average income in Maine is, what, around $39,000, is that correct?
The median. In the high 30s, late 40s.
Okay, so, and we all know that that's going to certainly have an adverse impact, especially in the retail world, because we know that's a huge aspect of where we have assistant managers and management in that range.
And we have a huge economy that depends on retail, because that's a large segment of the tourism sector, both retail in terms of stores and when we look at restaurants
hospitality, yep. All that aspect. And that is what makes Maine thrive, really, especially in terms of tourism.
Yes, yeah, so it's going to have a big impact for all those businesses who have, as Pam described, those assistant managers or those managers that make below what the new threshold would be. So make in the $30,000-$40,000 a year salary range and work a significant amount of overtime, particularly in the summer, because that's when the tourism is there and that's when you need people on the floor and they're covering shifts and they're covering for people who called out and they're covering a break and doing those non-exempt duties. And I think that gets us back to what are these duties that make you exempt versus non-exempt.
So let's break that down a little. So what are some of the duties that make that determination?
Well, the most common exemption, I'll give you an example, under the FLSA is the executive exemption. Under the FLSA, it's 541.1 of the law. And there's three major categories within that exemption. One is obviously, as we've previously discussed, a guaranteed salary of $455 or more a week. The second requirement would be the primary duty has to be management, but there's not necessarily a percentile to say if it's 50-50, if it's 60-40, but it's the primary duty because each work week could change, especially in a retail environment. You might have to cover a shift for somebody who's late, who called in late, and so that week you might have your primary duty a little more cited to non-exempt work versus the next week you're doing primary duties truly management. So we would look at the overall encompass if your primary duty truly is management. So that's the second requirement. The third requirement is to ensure that you supervise at least two full-time employees or the equivalent, which could be four part-time employees or a mixture of the two. If those three come into play, traditionally, that person would be exempt under Executive Exemption 541.1, which, while I'm quoting federal law, state law follows suit with the federal law.
It mirrors it.
So in that case, if anybody falls into that category, now those individuals would now have to be making the higher threshold. And the proposed, as I stated earlier, the proposed is 970. What the U.S. Department of Labor did was look at data from 2013 to come up with what they determine as the formula as the 40th percentile range. They stated that that's what was used back in 2004 when they made the last changes, and so they're doing the same thing on 2013, which was in the low 900 category as far as the salary threshold. But as of 2016, which is when these rules are proposed to come into effect, it would be at that 970 threshold. So that's what we're looking at is that 970, which is roughly over $50,000 a year.
Yeah, it's just a little over $50,000. So when you're thinking about how that's going to be enforced, right, in terms of the Department of Labor looking at that. First of all, let's back up a second. Does Maine have to change its law to then mirror the federal law if these go through? It's just a policy question, I guess.
Sure, and I can answer that. Under Title 26, Chapter 7, subparagraph 663, it does state under K, it states that the, and I'm going to paraphrase, so I'm not quoting it word for word, but the second part of K states the fact that if the U.S. Department of Labor changes or establishes a new rate under the FLSA, whatever's the higher rate, meaning whatever in statute currently in state statute, or if the USDOL establishes a higher rate, is what will have to be enforced. So when the feds make these changes, the Bureau of Labor Standards will now have to enforce whatever provides the greater protection to the individual, which at this case, if this goes through, would be the higher rules that USDOL is establishing. So then while an individual could still file a complaint with the Federal Department of Labor, for those businesses that are not covered under federal law, those individuals who have allegations of not making that new threshold would have to file a complaint with the state, and we'd have to look into those allegations.
Are there exemptions to this?
Under state law, which is different from federal law, there are no seasonal exemptions for seasonal employers. Under state law, if you have one employee, you are covered under state law. So in essence, there's probably no business out there unless you're truly a self-employed with no employees that this is not going to impact.
Right, because you had mentioned two employees, so I wanted to make sure the one employee category was covered. Right. Julie?
Well, and that's the distinction is there's a difference between whether the business falls under it, but would be the one employee, but that two employee rule would be who the exempt person is supervising. So those two FTE equivalents. There's a lot of challenges in interpreting some of these statutes, and there's even going to be probably some conflict at the federal level over this because the Fair Labor Standards Act has that 455 built into the statute, and this is a rules change. So it's not going through Congress to change the statute. It's a rules change being put out there by the executive branch. So we do anticipate that there will be legal challenges to this, and this may drag on for quite a while.
Will they be able to still enforce or put out this rule without that legal challenge? In other words, does it have to go through statute? I know I'm getting a little into inside baseball, but I thought I'd ask the question.
Well, I think it's a good question because it's Congress's duty to pass legislation, which would be the actual statute, and then the executive branch develops the rules as to how that statute will be enforced. Typically, the rules cannot supersede the authority of the statute. So in this case, we would have a conflict with that amount of defining what is the threshold for overtime between the rules and the statute. We know in our state law, when we're looking at statutes and legislation that's being proposed, that that's one of the tests that we give it. Is the rule that this legislator wants to put in going to supersede the authority of the actual statute? At the federal level, that's a similar case. But the Obama administration does seem to want to go forward and do things without having to go through Congress, which has a Republican majority in both houses and would likely not pass this. So it likely will be challenged and taken to the courts. Now, it will have to go into effect in order to be challenged. So we would assume that it will go into effect on January 1st of 2016. But this is one of the things that people can comment on during the public comment period.
So let's bring that up right now. We'll bring that up a couple of times during the show. Talk to me about what public comment means, because it sounds good. Sounds like I can make a comment. Do I just call into a hotline and give a comment, or do I have to do it in writing? How do I respond to this, and how do you tactfully or respectfully do it so that it doesn't have just somebody calling in and going, hey, this is dumb?
Well, most laws and rules, even at the state level, have this period of public comment where we publish the rule and we say, hey, this is what we're thinking of doing, and we invite the public to give us feedback on it. And the intent of it is to make sure that we didn't overlook something, that this is going to do what we are intending it to do, and that we take all viewpoints into account when we're developing public policy. The rulemaking and public comment period at the federal level is for exactly that same purpose. And people can submit comments a number of ways. You can do it online through the website, and we've given you the link to put online, regulations.gov. You also have the opportunity to write a letter, and it's a good idea to CC your members of Congress, so to copy Senators King and Collins, and then Congresswoman Pingree or Congressman Poliquin, depending upon which district that you're in. It's important to let them know that you are looking at this and you have concerns about this, whether you're in favor of it or whether you have concerns about it. It's important to let the federal government know what the feedback is going to be. And the more specifics that you can give when you comment on rules like this about what it's going to do to your business, about what the impact is going to be, both financially and in terms of staffing. And I think when we get into the discussions about duties and how you're going to look at duties with this change and may need to assign duties out, that is going to have an impact on jobs. I talked to an employer the other day who called the department very concerned about this. And she's like, you know, I told my workers, this doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be making $50,000 a year. It means that I'm going to split the duties out and I'm going to look at who's making what. And the assistant manager is going to continue to do X, Y, and Z. But the duties that are causing him or her to have overtime are going to be given to other workers who are paid less. And it's a similar conversation to when we have the minimum wage, that if the minimum wage goes up to $15 an hour, that you're no longer going to work 40 hours a week. Now you're going to work 30 hours a week. And those decisions are going to be made by employers. And so being specific about that when you do the public comment is what is of value to the agencies.
Well, you can do more harm than good if you just put out something that doesn't make a lot of sense. So it's really about taking the time to digest what it says and then properly commenting on it.
Right,
in terms
right.
of it. No, it makes a huge amount
right.
of sense.
When you show that you've reflected on what the actual impact of those changes are going to be in terms of your business, your employees, and what they're making and bringing home, that is going to be more impactful than kind of just going, you're at it again with those regulations and overstepping and things that we might think when we are concerned about regulations like this that impact businesses. But we want to show the real effects, not just our anger or frustration.
We're talking with Julia Rabinowitz. We're talking with Pam McGafflin, both from the Maine Department of Labor. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with two members of the Maine Department of Labor, Julie Rabinowitz and Pam McGafflin. And we're talking about, well, the new labor standards that are out there that are being talked about federally and talked about here in the state of Maine and how they're going to impact our state. And actually going to impact our country. Let's be
yes,
a little more broad
states,
with that. It's
going to
be all states. I think because, you know, this show reaches out beyond Maine. And I think in this particular case, it really does apply to a national discussion having to do with this. So, you know, I'm going to start, Pam, with you. So I'm an employer. And historically, if I said to myself, well, do I have to pay overtime for this person? Do I have to? Is this person a really, truly a salary position? You know, I'm thinking about a new position maybe, or I'm trying to clarify something, and I'm not scared to call you, right, first. Because
don't
I'm
be
like,
scared
right?
to call.
I'm saying,
don't
okay.
ever be scared.
Yeah, because I recognize that there's been a change at the DOL. I'm
business friendly.
So I'm going to pick up the phone. I'm going to call you. And I'm going to say, is this position eligible or cannot be eligible to be paid overtime? And you're going to say, what?
First of all, I'm going to thank you for calling me because I want to partner with the businesses to limit your liability so you don't misclassify an employee incorrectly. But then after we get over that conversation, I'm going to ask you duties that that individual performs and how you plan on paying that individual. I mean, obviously, we're talking about compensation and we're going to have to pay them on a guaranteed salary, which means you cannot make deductions for them from their salary generally. I mean, there are some exceptions to that when we talk about sick leave and PTO time or vacation time, but we're not going to get into the weeds on that part. If you tell me that in the example that we used in the previous segment, that they are going to be supervising an individual, they must supervise those for that executive exemption. They must supervise at least two full-time employees. Their primary duty has to be management. They will have to be paid or compensated on whatever that new threshold is going to be on these new rules. There's also two other very common exemptions. One is the professional exemption, which is simply exactly what it states, a professional exemption. Teacher, teacher, doctor, doctor, lawyer, lawyer. You have a degree or you have an academic training, it will say, because some computer training classes, you don't actually have to have a degree in IT. But you have a four-year degree, we'll say, in a specific academic environment, and then you're using that in your business. Or so again, the teacher, teacher, doctor, doctor, lawyer, lawyer is the most common one. Then you could also have what they call, and it's the most complicated one, is the administrative exemption. The reason why I don't like this one as much is because when we use the word administrative, we think clerical or administrative support staff, and that's not necessarily what this exemption means. Administrative is somebody who has a high level of independent discretion and judgment. So it's going to be somebody who can make major decisions, policy influencing, impacting financial business decisions. Somebody would be like, let's say, an HR director. Now, obviously, they probably supervise people, so they'll have a dual exemption. They can be executively exempt, but they'd most likely be administratively exempt because they're making major impacting decisions for the business as far as hiring, benefits, and everything that falls underneath the realm of HR. Safety directors, something to that extent. Maybe a CFO, if they don't supervise, could fall underneath an administrative exemption because they're making financial decisions based on the company. They don't have to do a checks and balances where they necessarily have to check with somebody else to make those types of decisions. That would be an administrative exemption. And those really are the three major exemptions. You do have a computer exemption for those people in IT, which is a little more complicated. And then there's an outside sales exemption too. But the major three are that executive, which is 541.1 of the law. Then you have the administrative, which is 541.2, and the professional, which is 541.3 of the FLSA.
Well, I'm just going to ask about the sales exemption part,
sure,
because there are a lot of people in Maine that do sales. So if you could just explain that one just a little bit, please.
Sure. The outside sales is really outside sales. Now, we have inbound coming calls like telemarketing and things of that nature where you have incoming sales. That does not apply to this exemption. This is, and I don't want to, I'm just going to use the, probably the worst case scenario, but like the door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesman person, that would be the outside salesperson, somebody who might be in the office a very small or minute time period to generate their leads, things of that nature, but then they're pounding the pavement after that and getting their sales outside, that most of their stuff is paid, or their compensation is generated, they're paid on a commission basis, 100%. Those individuals are actually exempt from minimum wage and overtime under the FLSA. So that's outside sales.
Okay, great. So just as a side note, having to do with 1099 contractors or subcontractors, does any of this apply to them?
Again, it's a misconception when somebody says, well, I get a 1099. Well, just because you get a 1099, that's more of an accounting or a tax issue, not a wage issue. When we're talking about 1099s, what we're really saying is that the employer deems that individual as an independent contractor, which both workers' comp, Department of Labor, both on the unemployment side as well as on the wage and hour side, can completely disagree with that interpretation of an independent contractor. What it comes down to, is there an employment relationship between the business and the individual? If the law can establish a relationship between those two where the individual truly is not in business for himself or herself, then they're going to be deemed an employee, and the employer would be liable for both the unemployment taxes, the wage and hour aspects of it, and the workers' comp.
So when we're talking about these new regulation changes, they don't really apply, obviously, to that level. You don't have
Correct.
To pay an independent contractor minimum wage.
Correct.
Okay, you can pay them whatever
right.
the amount
and that,
is.
And that independent contractor, part of what makes them an independent contractor is the opportunity for profit or loss. So if they underbid to get that contract, they're assuming that loss. And if it takes them more time and they end up making less than minimum wage, that is okay because that's what they bid and they're independent. They're not an employee.
No, that's a great definition. Okay, so again, a little bit more of the underlying definitions, a little more description. You talked about salary and salary exempt and salary non-exempt versus hourly. So let's define that a little bit.
Sure. The best way to do that is probably give you examples of positions.
Perfect.
Okay, so let's think, I'm thinking off the top of my head, landscaping industry. You can have somebody who is not falling in any of those nooks and crannies of what we previously discussed on the executive professional. It's just really the individual that's the boots on the ground doing the grunt work of the laboring in that industry. And it, an employer can choose to pay that person on a salary. Now, the difference is it a guaranteed salary, which means, you know, John Doe's always making $500 a week regardless if he works 30 hours or if he works 50 hours. Well, because he's non-exempt, meaning he's not going to fit into that niche of any of those exemptions, then John Doe would still have to be compensated overtime. But there are some carve-outs in the law that allow different ways to compute that overtime. So in this example, for simple math purposes, John Doe makes $500 a week, guaranteed. He works 50 hours a week, so equating that he makes $10 an hour. Well, the law still states that he has to be paid overtime for hours over 40. Well, because that guaranteed salary of $500 covers all his straight time earnings, then he's only due the half-time compensation for the hours of 40 through 50, which is 10 hours. So we already figured out that his regular rate of pay when we divide 50 by 500 is 10. He's due half-time, which is 5 of 10. So 5 times the 10 hours of 40 through 50 is additional $50. So in that week, John Doe's due $550, and he would satisfy the requirements for overtime because a straight time salary of $500 covers. Then he's just due the half time compensation for hours 10 through 50. If he works 60, then it's going to be time and a half of the hours 50 and above because that salary is based on a 50 hour work week. So, I mean, you can be paid on a salary. It really gets confusing, but you can be paid. There's legitimate ways to be paid on a salary and be non-exempt, but you're still going to have to pay them overtime in some fashion. In this case, it is, you know, half-time compensation for those hours over 40.
So you mentioned that that be based on a 50-hour work week. Who determines if it's 40, 50, 45? Can the employer determine that?
The employer determines that.
So when it comes to a non-exempt salary employee, that they can pick a different time other than the 40-hour work week.
And correct.
That's fine to be done.
That is fine as long as they pay them appropriately under both federal and state law.
Okay, perfect. Just gain some clarity out there in terms of it. Good. And Julie's over here.
We need a lot of clarity.
It is a lot. Well, these are not as simple as it sounds.
No.
I say it all the time.
They're not as simple as it sounds.
And there are a lot of employers that want to do the right thing. I've said it from the beginning. 99.9% of employers want to do the right thing. They just don't even know, or they think they're doing the right thing. And I'm usually pretty darn surprised when they're not.
Right? Exactly.
They're really surprised, like, how can that be?
And it's when they have those conversations with us, they want to do the right thing and go back and make those corrections. And we want people to be paid accurately and appropriately. And that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, great. All right, so there are white-collar exemptions under the FSLA. Talk a little bit about those.
The white-collar is what we were referring to before. The common terminology used out in the business field is white-collar versus blue-collar. And really that just means exempt versus non-exempt. So when somebody's a blue-collar employee, they're a non-exempt individual. When they're a white-collar, then that means that the employer's classifying them or holding, whether correctly or incorrectly, an exemption on that individual, which is going to have to fall into those niches, as we described earlier, the executive, professional, administrative, outside sales, or computer exemptions. If they don't follow in one of those categories with all the requirements in each one, because each one has different requirements, as we previously stated before, if they don't fall into those categories, then the employer has to pay them overtime. They have to meet those standards.
So how does minimum wage fit into this?
When we're referring to the exemptions, minimum wage is not an issue as long as they can hold that exemption. For non-exempt individuals, even on like the example that we used with the landscaping with John Doe, is at any point in time, should even on that guaranteed salary, I used the example for simple math, 550, so I could do the math in my head. If he was to work 70, 80 hours to where when you're dividing that 70, 80 into that 500, if it ever got below the 750 threshold for the state minimum wage, then the employer not only would have to bring up the difference to ensure that John Doe's paid minimum wage, but then would have to pay the halftime of whatever his regular rate of pay is for those hours over 40, from 40 to 80 or whatever the case might be.
So there are tests that you use for the USDOL for adjustments, right? Talk to me a little bit about what those are.
When we're talking about the tests, I'm kind of gave you some of the definitions already for most of those. Currently, in these proposed rules that the Federal Department of Labor has put out, they are not looking to actually change the duties. What they are doing is asking for soliciting comments and suggestions and in that rulemaking package, which can be also downloaded. It's a PDF online. I would encourage people probably not to print it out. It's like 260 pages. But there are,
of course it is.
but if you were to scan through it, I think it's on like page 96 where it asks employers or anybody that's or individuals who are looking to provide public comment that they list, you know, a handful of questions related to should they make changes to the duties, and if so, what would employers like to see in that? And that's more so they're trying to gear it for clarification. That they're also asking if there should be a percentile on when we're talking the primary duty. Should it be a 50-50 split, or should there be an industry for like retail where you might have a manager who has to ring somebody up because of an overflow of customers coming in? Should it be a 60-40 split for specific industries if that's the case? So, I mean, they're asking for information, but they're not looking to change those duties at this point in time.
You know, this is the problem with the one-size-fits-all model, right? So that when they have just a regulation that doesn't necessarily have any flexibility to allow for different industries, it does create a problem in terms of, for some industries, like retail, use the example, which I come from that background, so I get it. You do have these managers that have to jump on. They have to do things to get things moving in the organization. You don't have a choice in a store.
Right.
If somebody doesn't show up or if
you've
something doesn't happen, you got to cover it. There isn't a choice. And so that does make it a challenge in terms of the regulation.
And that's why I went back earlier when we were talking about on that executive exemption. Again, I hate to give a blanket response, but if an individual called and complained the fact that they're performing more non-exempt duties than exempt duties, we would have to look into the allegation and make that determination. But in industries, as in retail or in restaurant, if a manager, because somebody calls in or is a no-show, has to jump on, you know, the fry cooker for a period of half an hour or an hour or half a day because they wait to call in somebody else. That's still primary duty, because one of the responsibilities as a manager is to oversee the workflow. And if you have to be, you know, boots on the ground for a short period of time in the inner room until somebody can come in to do a relief work, that's part of management. It's just that consistently, overall, the big picture, if you're performing more non-exempt work versus exempt work, then you're probably going to be losing that exemption.
We're talking with Julia Rabinowitz and Pam McGafflin, and we are talking with them about what is going on with the new USDOL regulations that are coming out in regards to exempt and non-exempt. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Pam McGafflin, the Director of Bureau of Labor Standards from the Maine Department of Labor, and Julia Rabinowitz, the Director of Communications and Operations. Hello.
Hello. Are we having fun yet? We're having a great time.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, labor standards. I mean, what could be more fun?
It's not the most exciting topic, but it's something that's really critical.
It is critical. No question about that. And you know what? This show, we have some fun topics, and we have some really important topics. Not that they're all not important. I just want to be clear with that. All right? But this is
exactly
good stuff.
This is a very important
This
topic.
Is very important. And it is going to have a huge impact on everywhere in terms of this. All right. So, you know, Julie, if I could just ask you to start off and say, how is the Department of Labor going to communicate this information to the employers? That's, you know, how is that going to come out from the Department of Labor?
Well, we are, since we're not the regulatory authority instigating this, we're more of an awareness generator. So obviously being on your show is a great opportunity, and we appreciate that, and thank you. We do have our employer newsletter, and an issue went out in the middle of July that had this is the lead story. Our employer newsletter, you can sign up from the homepage at maine.gov/labor, and that newsletter goes to anyone who signs up for free, and we target this one for employers. It's really just blurbs and links of short bits of information that take you to the bigger pieces of information. It's not like a journal, and we're giving you, you know, loads
it's
of stuff that you can't
format,
use.
Really.
It's news you can use. Yeah. It's targeted specifically for HR people and the small business owner who's doing the HR functions. So that went out in July, and we continue to raise awareness. We have, through the Bureau of Labor Standards, you can call and ask questions, but we also do employment law for employer programs, and we will talk about it in those venues. We do probably a dozen of those a year all over the state, and those are free. You can see those listed on our website at safetyworks.com, and also we put out press releases several times a year, and we highlight those also in the employer newsletter. And then we will be doing HR Day at DOL again this year, and we're looking to take it to not only host it in Augusta at our headquarters, but also in a couple other places in the state during the fall. And that information will be available on our website and in that employer e-newsletter as well.
No, that's great. Good. We got to get the information out. That's the important part here. All right, so Pam, I'm an employer. All right, let me give you a scenario. I'm an employer, and I say to myself, okay, I have to do something about the fact that they're going to be changing what I would perceive as my, you know, exempt salaried person's rate from, well, let's say they're making $42,000 a year, and now I have to make a decision if I'm going to bring them up to the $50,440 threshold here to keep them on a salary. So I say, okay, I have to make a determination, but I only have so many dollars. I only have so many dollars in the pot. I didn't suddenly increase my sales by $10,000, well, it'd be really $8,000 approximately. And that's a big deal for me to increase this person's salary and to make those determinations, right? So I have to determine, oh, do I raise them to a salary and keep them salary? Do they fit all the criteria? Let's say they fit all the criteria. Let's just make that assumption somewhere on the criteria they fit it. So do I raise them? But then I got to take the money from somewhere. So it might affect their benefits. It might affect their bonuses. It might affect their compensation overall. How do employers start making these decisions and do it legally?
Excellent question. Well, by all means, they can always contact our office. We are staffed daily, well, Monday through Friday during normal business hours. There are individuals staffed on the phones to answer common questions that businesses or individuals have. But to answer your question specifically, the key thing here is because that we're focusing on the threshold of the salary going up. If you have an individual who's making $42,000 a year, in order to maintain that exemption, you will have to pay them the $50,440, or otherwise you can't claim that exemption. That's number one. Then once you decide if that's the case, that you're going to pay them that type of salary threshold now, and assuming that we're going to, that their duties are going to remain the same, their primary duty is going to, I'm going to use that easy one, that executive exemption, that their primary duty is still going to be management and they're doing the supervision ratio correctly, then you could hold that exemption. But as you pointed out, you know, that is a big jump for you as a business to jump somebody up roughly $10,000 for their annual salary. So you will have to look at cost savings if you're not going to look to increase your sales to offset those additional costs for compensation. Then you're going to have to look at other means to take care of that, as you said, through benefits or reductions of other types of bonuses, things of that nature.
So when somebody's putting together a compensation thought process, they really do have to look at the total amount, that the total comp somebody's mm-hmm. going to be making in terms of it. And I recognize that the regulation doesn't say that, right? It just talks about the salary or the amount they have to be paid. Does the Department of Labor get involved with total compensation discussions, or is it just on the base compensation?
There are certain provisions under the law that if an employer was to violate those laws, and we were looking for to in order to get the employer back into compliance and make that individual whole as if no violations occurred, we do have to look at total compensation, especially if they've been terminated from a job and we're having to bring them back. So we have to look at their benefits, their bonuses, even down to the point of where their desk and what color phone they have, and things of that nature. But traditionally, we only look at the minimum wage and the overtime aspect of it.
All right, so second scenario, employer has the same salary, let's use the same salary, $42,000 currently, would have to bring it up to $50,440, but they are now going to look at the amount of time that they manage, and they maybe fall below currently because they're in the retail world, and the threshold may be, for the new regulations, 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're going to be 60-40, and they're not going to necessarily fit that regulation. So employers say to themselves, how can I make that fit? I look at job descriptions. I try to, you know, change the duties. I try to dish that amount of information or what they did off to somebody else, and that changes that person. How do they work through that process, and is there a criteria they can go through? Is there a checklist they can go through? How do they make that happen? And she's smiling, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, it's a kind of a difficult question. One thing I always tell employers, I can't make their decisions, business decisions for them. What I can give them is the tools, but ultimately they have to make those choices. And in that case, what's going to happen is the business is going to have to decide if they need to hire more part-time help to offset those costs, or are they going to look at that true salaried exempt individual's duties and then take some of those duties away from that individual, those non-exempt duties we'll talk about, and give those to lower-level employees. But then again, if that lower-level employee is already putting in 40 hours a week and then you're going to delegate more responsibility to that individual, are you now going to have to pay overtime for that other individual? So I mean, it's a balancing act. I mean, if you take away all these extra duties to ensure that their primary duty maintains to be to maintain that exemption, and you give a lot of those non-exempt duties now to lower level staff, then is that going to raise their hours? Are you going to be required to hire part-time help to offset those costs? I mean, again, it's decisions that businesses are really going to have to look at the big picture.
Well, I do know that there's always this confusion around what we talked about a little bit earlier, which is salary but non-exempt, right? Because people say when they get mm-hmm. half-time overtime, I have seen employers go, what is this? And they don't quite understand this half-time thing, right? And employers sometimes get, they call and they say, I don't get it either. So all this is an education process for the employer,
right?
Because we're going to have to get creative sometimes here. We're talking about doubling, literally,
right,
what the exemption is. We have to get creative, and employers are going to have to look to creative solutions in terms of this within the law.
Correct. And I caution employers, I mean, while I encourage them to do creative accounting, there's a gray area there to where creativity results in violations. So again, if you're coming up with scenarios, if businesses are coming up with scenarios on how to offset the cost of this, if this is the case, I highly encourage them to seek our assistance online. We have information that we post online, as Julie Rabinowitz discussed. We have that ER newsletter that they can sign up for that gives them little blog ideas, as well as just contact our office and speak to my staff. As Julie also mentioned, we do education outreach events throughout the year. If there is a need for an association or anybody else that wants one of my staff members or myself to speak at, they can just call and I'll schedule in our time. You know, as long as you give me a little bit of notice, I speak at many different association events where I can, lots of times it's just a question and answer. I might speak for 10, 15 minutes, just a broad overview, and then 45 minutes of nothing, you know.
Yeah, let them come, right?
You know, just ask all the questions you can, and I'll give you my best choice of the responses I can give you.
Well, one other question that I'll ask, because this is a question that has come up recently in discussion, has to do with cell phone and email use in terms of hourly employees and or exempt employees.
Yes.
And so rather than get into a scenario, let me just ask, what is the general thought process for the Maine Department of Labor having to do with employees that now go on their cell phones or anything and may do work with or without the employer knowing?
Right. Excellent question. This is actually a serious issue that comes up often. But let me preface with one thing. The mere inconvenience of having to be on call or carrying a cell phone is not compensatable because you're not working. And you're being inconvenienced to carry that cell phone or being on call for the weekend, which means if the employer says you can't drink or anything to that extent, there's still no compensation that you can't go to the barbecue and have alcoholic beverage if that's the case. It's not compensatable. But when you're carrying a phone or a laptop or anything else of electronical device, and whether the employer allows you to or you choose to do it at your own discretion to go through your email on the weekends or respond to other types of information or work on documents and stuff, that is considered work time and has to be considered into the compensation when we're talking about non-exempt individuals. When we're talking about exempt, you can work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. As long as you're paid on the guaranteed salary and meet all those other thresholds, it's not going to matter under the law. But when you're talking about a non-exempt individual, if the person is, you know, going through the emails on the nights and weekends, the employer and the employee has to come up with some type of record-keeping requirement because it is under the law the employer's responsibility to maintain accurate records of hours worked. So they're going to have a communication between the two individuals, the business and the individual, to figure out how to track that record of work time. And that has to be figured into that work week because, again, overtime is based on the work week. Each work week stands alone. So you can't average it out. You can't say, I worked 45 this week in the biweekly pay period, so I'll work 35 next week, so there's no overtime. That is illegal. Each work week stands alone. If you work 45 this week, you have to be compensated that extra 5 hours of overtime for those non-exempt employees.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We're talking about labor standards, and we will be right back.
You don't need to get a second job as a stuntman to save money. You just need feedthepig.org. Don't get left behind. Get tips and tools at feedthepig.org. Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz from the Maine Department of Labor and Pam McGafflin from the Maine Department of Labor. I'm not going to go through the titles. We've done it through the show.
We're good.
Okay, titles are all right. Plus, they're long. The state titles. Big surprise.
There you go.
All right, yeah, we're having fun. They're laughing. And I'll see them in my office, I'm sure, in a week. All right, we're moving on. Here we go. All right, so we're talking. Julie, we've talked a lot about labor standards today.
Yes.
One of the topics I'd like to end the show with is on the minimum wage, because there's a lot of discussion having
yes.
to do with
Hot
the minimum
topic.
Wage. Hot topic. And so last month, to start off, just as a general statement, the city of Portland raised the minimum wage $10.10 an hour. If we go back even a month before that, in the state house, they failed to pass a bill preventing local minimum wage to happen.
Right.
And so there's this calling also at the federal level for a minimum wage increase. You now have federal contractors required to be at $10.10 an hour. You have places like Seattle and other places in California that are saying $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd like to make about a dollar an hour at least. That would be nice as an owner, right? Would that be the amount I'd like to make? I mean, come on. That's what I make.
You're exempt.
And I'm sure I'm exempt. There no question. Go. I'm exempt from making money. That's what that is. No question. The reality is that this is a hot topic. So what does the Department of Labor think of all this? What are some of the challenges you see with it and so forth? And I'll let you go from
there. Sure. We do make a distinction at the Department of Labor between the minimum wage and the living wage. I think a lot of the discussion about people should earn a wage that they can live on is a discussion about the living wage. And that is a career wage. That is a wage you earn with your skills and by continuously increasing and upgrading your skills, because skills are the proxy value for wages. That's what employers are paying for. For the department, when we look at who makes the minimum wage, 52% of people who make the minimum wage are people under the age of 24. They're part-time workers and they're early in their careers. They are not bringing those higher level skills. Often they're living at home. They're not providing for a family on the minimum wage. Only probably fewer than 3,800 people in 2013 in Maine were full-time workers making the minimum wage. And that would include people who earn tips. So those individuals were actually making more than the minimum wage. We just weren't factoring that in when we look at the economic data from the Center for Workforce Research and Information. It's fewer than a percentage of the workforce. It's a very small percentage of people. What we are looking at when we think about the minimum wage is Maine's competitiveness against other states. During the gubernatorial campaign, the governor said that he was in favor of the minimum wage going up if it went up at the federal level in what was equal across the board, because that wouldn't put Maine at a disadvantage. What we're looking at in the state of Maine when we talk about our workforce challenges is our labor shortage that we're getting because all these baby boomers are retiring. We're looking at in the next 15 to 20 years seeing a net decrease in the number of workers of 100,000. We're looking at about 7,000 baby boomers retiring every year from now for the next 20 years. Our labor force is shrinking. Our labor market is getting tighter. We have employers competing for workers, so that's a supply-demand issue. Wages go up. Wages in the Portland area and in York County are going to go up at a faster rate than, for example, wages in Presque Isle or Washington County. But all the metropolitan regions of Maine, Bangor, Lewiston, Auburn, and Portland in particular, are going to see fairly consistent increases in wages across the board as they compete for workers in those localities. Artificially adjusting that to a statewide rate is a concern because Presque Isle is not going to afford the same kind of minimum wage as Portland, and we don't want to disadvantage any community economically. We want everyone to rise to the level that their area can sustain. The local movement to raise the minimum wage is also of a concern, and it's a slightly different concern than the competitiveness issue, although that does play into it, because obviously Westbrook and South Portland will be more competitive locations for businesses that have a lower wage threshold of worker. And it doesn't have to be the minimum wage, because if Portland is raising their minimum wage to $10.10, the state minimum wage is $7.50. It affects all your workers between that $7.50 and really the $11 to $12 an hour range, because your $11 an hour worker is going to say, well, the $8 an hour worker just got a $2.10 raise. Where's my $2.10 raise? There are special issues that come with the local minimum wage. And that is why the governor put in the bill to have minimum wage consistency and have one minimum wage for the whole state. And several states have those bills. That was not something unique to Governor LePage saying we just want this here in Maine and to take away local control. It's really about ensuring a competitive playing field and a floor through which no one can go below. Wage and hour laws are enforced at the jurisdiction that is most protective for the worker. So when we look at USDOL laws versus Maine laws, the federal minimum wage is $7.25. The state one is $7.50. So Pam McGafflin's bureau enforces $7.50. And usually most minimum wage complaints that go to USDOL get referred to the state so that we can enforce the higher level of wage because that's most protective for the worker. State agencies do not enforce local ordinances. So in this case, the city of Portland is going to assume those enforcement responsibilities. Now, when we look at what cities have to enforce, they enforce, you know, building codes and fire codes. They also enforce, you know, restaurant health inspections. We get concerned because Portland does not, to our knowledge, they have not yet set up an enforcement mechanism to take these calls. When Mayor Brennan testified against that bill that the governor put in for minimum wage consistency, he said at the time that they thought that those calls would go to the city manager's office and then they would decide what to do with them. Well, we're looking at a big increase between $7.50 and $10.10, and a lot of employers are going to miss the boat. And when workers are not getting paid what they're supposed to be getting paid, they need a place to call. But for a level playing field piece of it, you need to have enforcement so that all employers are following the law. And when you're competing against another employer, you know that they're doing what is legally required and they're not undercutting or skirting below. If you don't have an enforcement mechanism, you open up the opportunity for employers to say, well, is the city going to come in and force me to do this? You can't send the restaurant inspector to look at your payroll. It's just not going to be an effect. You can't have the city HR folks looking at private employers' payroll because that's not their duty and it's not what they're charged to do and it's not their expertise.
So to be clear, so that we make sure we get this from a clarity standpoint, Pam, if you got a call from someone in the city of Portland and they said, I'm not being paid properly, and you say, okay, what's the issue? And they say, well, I'm not getting my $10.10 an hour because it's my minimum wage. And you go, well, what are you being paid? And they go, I'm being paid $9 an hour. And you go, well, you're already being paid the state requirement. You're going to have to call the city.
Exactly.
Right? Because I can't do anything about it because I'm the state, and the state, you're being paid what the state requires.
And in fact, it's not just the ones that call and complain. What people need to realize is that when we filter in complaints, because people complain about other allegations related, not maybe related to minimum wage, if something comes through one of my staff's desk and they realize that they're not being paid $10.10 an hour in Portland, all those current caseloads that we have are now going to be shifted over to the city of Portland because it would behoove that individual to file their complaint with the city because they would be receiving $10.10 an hour, which includes one of the laws that we have is the final paycheck on cessation of employment. A lot of those final paycheck calls that we get for the city of Portland, which is a huge metropolitan, which has a lot of businesses, are now going to be referred over to Portland. So it's going to reduce some of my workload, but on the backside of somebody in the city of Portland.
Yeah, you know, it's going to create an interesting mess.
Yeah, right. And it only affects the workers who work in the city of Portland. If you have a Westbrook Brands or their home health care and they never set foot in the city of Portland when they're doing their work, they don't have to be paid the Portland minimum
wage. So it's where
wage.
They work, not yes. necessarily
where the work's performed.
So if I'm an employer and I have a home health care business and I'm in Portland, based in Portland,
right.
but my employees don't ever work
They're
in
only
Portland.
In Oxford County or York County, never come to Portland, they're going to be paid. You can pay them the state minimum wage.
So you have competition with employees within the same business entity as well.
So, yeah, morale. Just think about the sense of somebody works in the city of Portland one day a week and the rest are somewhere else.
They only have to be paid the
10,
Portland
10
minimum
for
wage
that
for
one
that
day.
Day.
Oh, this is going to be
great. It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. And I'm sure as we move through this process, we'll learn more about it and it will be interesting. I got to thank you very much. I know we've come to the end of the show today. The HR Power Hour will post all this information directly after the show. You can go to hrpowerhour.com. You can find their lovely faces and you can also see bios about both of them, Pam and Julie, as well as links to connect with both of them. Again, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Dave. We appreciate it.
Thank you for listening and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.